Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with economist Jeffrey Sachs. He is internationally known for working on some of the world's toughest economic and social problems. He's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and also is special advisor to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. We'll talk about some of the ideas in his newly published book, The Price of Civilization. The subtitle is Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. And in the book, he explains that when he started his career as an economist, he decided to concentrate on economic challenges outside of the United States, where he felt that the problems were most in need of attention. Now, he says, he worries about his own country. And in the book, he has thoughts on America's ongoing economic crisis, as well as some ideas for a new approach to politics and economics, something that relies on both business and government to promote fairness and productivity. The book is just recently out. It is published by Random House. He's spending time traveling around the country talking about it. He's in Chicago and is joining us by phone, and we're pleased that he could be with us. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. We hope people can keep their comments brief, but anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, if you're here where we are, Champaign-Urbana, the first number is yours, 333-9455. And anywhere you might be listening, if it's a long-distance call, use the toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email. You'd like to do that. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Sachs, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Very good. Happy to be here in Chicago.
Good. Well, we're pleased that you could be talking with us. You know, I think it's interesting because you suggest that if we're going to understand where we are now and the problems that we have with the economy, you have to go back further than, say, 2008 or 2006 or 2000. And that, it, you know, in as much as we are in a time now when distrust of government is very high, if you go back to the 70s, you can find a time when distrust of government was similarly high. It was a period where there had been a lot of dislocation in politics. There were a lot of economic shocks. Somebody came along, a fellow happened to be named Ronald Reagan. Somebody came along and said, well, you know what the problem is here? The problem is government. And that really resonated with people and still does. And you seem to be making the argument that an awful lot of the problems that we're having dealing with our problems today goes all the way back to that idea that took hold in the 1980s, that really the cause of all of our problems is the government.
Well, I was watching the Republican debate last night, as I'm sure many people were, and they were definitely channeling President Reagan's sentiments and, in fact, saying we have to go back to those halcyon days. But I do see it as a kind of turning point for America. The problems in the 1970s were very serious and very real and very disconcerting. The U.S. dollar was knocked from the pedestal as the sole key currency in the world. There was high inflation. We had the oil price shocks of 1973 and 1979. We had food price increases. We had the beginnings of quite intense competition in the manufacturing sector from Japan initially, but then more generally from Asia. I interpret this as really the beginnings of the challenges of the new globalization. The world economy after World War II was a totally U.S.-dominated economy. We were not only very vibrant economy, but we were the last one standing of the industrial world. So the U.S. Dominated the scene, but by the 1970s, there was enough economic growth, the recovery in Europe and Japan, and the China at the end of the 1970s, which changed the situation for the United States. My view is that Ronald Reagan came to office on January 20th, 1981, with a clear diagnosis that was just absolutely wrong. Instead of pointing to the new globalization, instead of pointing to the new challenges that the U.S. would face in an increasing information age economy, President Reagan said that what we had to do was shrink government and shrink it in an especially odd way, major tax cuts at the top, and slashing government services in the domestic U.S. economy as, quote, compensation. So the top tax rates came down during the Reagan years from around 70% to 28%, and the spending of the U.S. government on the U.S. economy in areas like transport, energy, science and technology, environment, education, everything that we call the domestic discretionary budget, basically domestic spending that isn't the big transfer programs, all of that was reduced dramatically. And I think that's the legacy that we're seeing right now. It's gone on for 30 years. Each president since then has basically followed the same course. And listeners will be surprised to know that when Senator Obama was campaigning to be President Obama, his two top economic campaign advisors wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in August 2008, which said very explicitly, if I'm elected president, if President Obama's elected president, the tax to national income ratio will be the same as during the Reagan administration, around 17.5%, 18% of national income. And yet President Obama has said that we need to rebuild the country with infrastructure, with renewable energy, with higher skills, with science and technology, with higher education. But the problem has been that those aspirations, which I really share, have been disconnected from the budget side. And that disconnect is why we're spinning around in circles. The only real budget idea that the president has had is short-term stimulus, not long-term rebuilding. The Republican side says, well, no, we don't agree with either of those approaches. We just want to cut taxes more and cut government spending more. And I find that extraordinary because we are suffering such a serious shortage right now of skilled work, of our kids being able to complete school, of rundown neighborhoods, of environmental harms, of an energy system that doesn't work, and the list goes on and on. But the Republican side says that's not even the responsibility of government. Ron Paul wants to shut down the Department of Energy, wants to shut down the Department of Education and other key parts of our government. So this is the problem, yeah, in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, and it seems it's striking that it's not striking that Republicans have been so consistent in the message for all these years, but they still continue to say the same message. The problem is, even the most recent downturn in the economy, the problem is the government. Government is too big, spends too much money. So what we want to do is shrink government by starving it of resources. We do that by cutting taxes so that government has less money to spend. And then also coupled with that is this idea that, well, if we're not taking money out of people's pockets, then they will then turn around and take that money and at least spend it or hopefully invest it in ways that generates new jobs. I mean, that's been the argument for such a long time now.
Yes, and it's so sadly simple-minded, because for 100 years, actually the truth is for more than 200 years, we've known that to have a dynamic private sector economy anywhere, but including the United States, you need a government that functions, and not only to enforce private sector contracts, but also to help build the highway system, to help ensure that there's an energy infrastructure, to help ensure that there is good public health, to help ensure that children are educated and adults have skills, to help promote the very technologies such as the computer age, the information revolution, genomics, biomedical sciences, renewable energy, and so forth that we depend on, because it's also been known since the kings and queens of hundreds of years that to promote science, you need patronage. The patrons that used to be the kings and queens, now they are the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and other agencies, DARPA, which gave us the beginnings of the Internet, for example. And all of this is denied in this simple, simplistic, destructive, ideological assault on government. And the Democrats, unfortunately, more or less go along with the Republicans on this. And the only difference is the Republicans do it gleefully, and the Democrats do it wringing their hands, apologizing, saying, oh, we wish we didn't have to do it. We have a budget squeeze. In the meantime, the ones that are laughing literally all the way to the bank are the rich and the bankers, Wall Street and others, who have walked away with the prize economically and politically, who don't pay taxes in commensurate with the soaring share of national income that they've enjoyed over the last 30 years and the soaring share of wealth that they dispose of and the increasing ease with which they hide that wealth in international tax havens. So this is the strange thing, which is that a lot of the fervor for this, you see the cheering of working people and middle-class people who are really doing the bidding of the wealthy in this country by buying into the argument that the most important thing is to keep the taxes low on the rich and then turn around and realize that, well, there's nothing we can do. I guess we just can't have those teachers. We just can't have our kids complete in college. We just can't rebuild those roads and so on. It's sad.
That's just
we have much better choices in our country.
It continues to mystify me why it is that people who have not benefited would continue to support the same policies. And when if someone comes along and says, well, really, we have a problem here that big corporations and wealthiest Americans aren't paying their fair share, and one might argue whether that is or is not the case. But if you then say, what we're going to do is we're going to raise taxes on people at the very top in a way that should not affect an awful lot of Americans, why is it that people whose taxes will not go up will still say, no, you can't do that. Taxes are too high, and that's just not the way to go.
I think there are two problems at work here. One is that actually a majority of the American people support raising taxes on the rich. And when the question is asked specifically that way in opinion surveys, as opposed to the question, do you favor raising taxes, then you get strong majorities. There were, for example, roughly 60% majorities in favor of ending the Bush-era tax cuts on the highest income bracket. And that 60% has been more or less constant for the last 6 or 7 years that issue was discussed, the rolling back or ending of the Bush-era tax cuts. But politics did not translate that majority opinion into a favorable outcome. And that, I believe, is because our politics goes through a kind of filter. The filter is who contributes to the campaigns. That's companies and wealthy people. And they have their views magnified in the Washington hot pot to an incredible extent. So even when the American people want something, it doesn't mean it translates. We're facing that in New York right now, where there's a big majority of New Yorkers who want the state government to keep on a millionaire's tax. It's a surcharge on people earning more than $1 million. The governor is steadfast in wanting to end it. But I think that's a political ploy of the governor rather than a reflection of the wishes of the voters. So I think that's one problem. One problem is the politicians listen to their rich contributors and to the corporate lobbies rather than to the American people. The second is that there's a tremendous amount of propaganda, corporate propaganda and confusion, which equates the two different statements. One is taxes raised at the top versus taxes raised. And the anti-tax forces, which are mainly backed by billionaires like the Koch brothers or Rupert Murdoch and others, conflate those two very different ideas so that people in listening to the debates and so forth think that this is going to hit them, and they feel squeezed already, and they just can't imagine being squeezed more. And it's been rather hard to separate those two. I think in very recent weeks, President Obama's doing a better job of separating those two, but it's been a late start, and he too looks much too much to big campaign contributors rather than to the so-called median voter.
Our guest in this hour focus is Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Earth Institute and is professor of sustainable development and health policy and management at Columbia University. His ideas, the things that we're discussing here this morning, can be found in a new book that he's published. The title is The Price of Civilization. It's published by Random House. He's traveling around the country to talk about it. He's in Chicago, and we're pleased that he could be with us for a while this morning. We have a caller and would welcome others. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yes. This is a, one part question, one part statement. First question. First off, how is it that if anyone making so much money, say, because you only got, 1%, 2% that controls all the wealth in America, what footing do they have to object any type of tax increase for them, especially since they, for the last 30-some-odd years, been getting a free ride? First question. And then the statement, if the Democrats and Republicans are pretty much hand and foot together, why is it that we as a people can't seem to come along, get together and come up with another political party that is actually for the people and do what the people want and not taking bribes pretty much? I don't care if you want to call them whatever, but taking bribes or whatever to get companies' agendas passed, not the people. Anyway, that's it.
All right. Well, there's two questions for you, Professor Sachs.
Well, they make two arguments about why they shouldn't pay more in taxes. First is this argument that, quote, they are the job creators. This is something we're hearing a lot these days. It's mostly phony. They've been a lot of job destroyers also. Look what Wall Street ended up doing to the American economy. And the idea of trickle-down economics that you just give to the millionaires and billionaires and somehow it's going to trickle down to the rest of us has been proven wrong for decades. But that's one argument that is repeated. And there's a sad fact that even when there really are jobs being created, such as the innovations from Apple, which have created so many of our favorite products in recent years, the real employment to make the iPhones and the iPads and so on, and it's hundreds of thousands of jobs, those are in China, not in the U.S. And so unless we have a skilled workforce, unless we're able to compete effectively, even when we do actually innovate, those jobs won't be jobs in which U.S. workers are going to be able to compete. This is a point that the National Association of Manufacturing itself made a few days ago in a study which said we have a shortage of skilled craftsmen, of machinists, of systems engineers. That's hundreds of thousands of jobs that are going unfilled in this country because we don't have the trained workforce to do it. The second argument that they make is that, well, they pay a disproportionate percent of the income tax, and therefore they're doing their fair share. This has to be disentangled. There's so many things to say about it. But first of all, they count in that only the income tax, whereas every worker in this country basically pays Social Security, pay the payroll taxes, they pay excise taxes. And so if you look at the share that's paid by the rich of overall taxes, it's much, much lower than the number that they advertise. Sometimes it's said that 40% of Americans pay no taxes. This is nonsense. Even if they're not paying an income tax, they're paying a very significant load of payroll taxes and sales taxes and other taxes that add up for them at much lower salaries. Now, the real point is actually something I think more important, which is that the incomes at the top have soared almost unimaginable. The top 1% of our earners right now take home around 21 or 22% of the total income of all households, the highest ratio since just before the Great Depression. And so they've had a bonanza. And while they pay income tax on that, the rate of income tax, the share of their income that they actually pay in income tax, has actually declined. It's not gone up over the last 30 years. So they've had a bonanza, but they've not been asked to contribute any part of that other than a declining proportion to the government. When it comes to the companies, the situation's even worse, because our corporations are making lots of profits. Of course, these corporations are owned by the wealthy primarily, and these corporations have been enabled to hide their profits in the Cayman Islands, in Bermuda, in offshore tax havens. Our corporate tax collection this year will be about 1.5% of national income, just about the lowest ratio that we've had in decades. And this is because we have progressively undermined our corporate system through allowing companies to claim that their profits are actually foreign profits, and then to direct those foreign profits to foreign tax havens. It's a racket to a very significant extent. And I don't think there's any deep economic justification for it. And I think it has led to a society that is so unequal that what used to be considered the great world's middle-class society is so divided right now that the middle class, where it exists, is just struggling to hold on. The rich have seemingly had a kind of liftoff into orbit that they're just soaring above the rest of us. And, of course, the numbers of people, especially children, living in outright poverty has been rising. So I think I don't find any of the arguments persuasive, but they make them nonetheless. I think they're self-serving. But when you own the megaphone, you can make the arguments, and if you make them often enough, something seems to stick. When it comes to what to do about this politically, this really is a big conundrum, because both our political parties are increasingly in the hands of powerful lobbying interests. And that has prevented clear thinking by either party. Now, the Republicans, they have long been at the right of center. They've moved farther and farther to the right. Sometimes it's almost, I think, a kind of parade of selfishness these days, because there's a denial of any social responsibility towards people in need. In fact, the unemployed are mocked. They're lazy. It's their own fault, and so on. It's dreadful. But the Democrats, which I think fairly used to be called the left of center party, really are on a reasonable political spectrum to the right of center right now, because while there's a variation within the Democratic Party, they too have supported financial deregulation, big bonuses at the top, and low tax rates. And in fact, a lot of Democrats are talking about further cuts of the corporate tax rate, supposedly to make us more competitive, but I think in a way that would do even greater damage to our country. So both parties are in the hands of these interests, and the question is, can something be done about it? Well, if money really is the only ticket to political power, then the competition over money is probably pretty deeply locked in place. And when politicians are appealing for money, they're not appealing to us. They're appealing to the rich. And so that would make it quite tough. My own view, though, is, and I admit this is pretty speculative, but my own guess is that the public is so disgusted at this point with the corruption, with the self-dealing, with the sanctimony of the rich, with the claims of Wall Street that they're doing God's work as they bring the economy down, as they get bailed out, as they take billions of dollars of bonuses, that if candidates can get organized and start campaigning under a banner of not taking big donor money, of not accepting PACs and super PACs, and I saw today in the morning news that Herman Cain has a new super PAC, in other words, a way for companies to be giving large corporate contributions to do his bidding, so that he would do their bidding, I should say. If we could get politicians to swear off of that, I think that by itself could become a major competitive advantage in elections, because my guess is that there are enough ways now for candidates to have their views heard. There's a lot of free media, there's the social networks, there's YouTube, rather than paid commercial television. And if a smart set of candidates uses the smart new media effectively, I think that they could do quite well on a limiting themselves to $100 and less contributions and still be politically competitive. And we could see a shift to politicians who aren't on the take, and that's definitely what we need.
Our guest in this hour, Focus, is economist Jeffrey Sachs. He's on the faculty at Columbia University, where he's director of the Earth Institute. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an after hour till 2:30 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, ice cream, and specialty coffees. Bevere offers Wi-Fi. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week, and we have 10 different topics, Monday through Friday. In the second hour of the program today, our guest is Martha Gillette. She is professor of cell and developmental biology at the University of Illinois, and she is interested in how it is that living things, humans and others, keep track of time. There is an internal clock running in all of us, and it has a lot to do with regulating our behavior, and certainly if that clock is not working correctly, that can cause problems. We'll talk with her about some of the research that she has been doing in this area. Then tomorrow we have another health-related show for you. Our guest will be pharmacist Dr. James Rybacki. He's been here on the program before, just to do general program with us on prescription medications and what they do. We will be doing that, but we'll have a particular focus as well. We'll talk about osteoporosis. And in addition to James Rybacki, joining us will be Mary Bucksign. She's an assistant professor in the area of orthopedic surgery at the Harvard Medical School. They'll both be joining us by phone. We're here weekday mornings, as I say, from 10 to noon. And if you'd like to check up on the schedule or listen to past programs, you can go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. The guest in this hour focus is Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He has been a special advisor to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. He is, in addition, a professor at Columbia, professor of sustainable development and health policy and management, and is the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Random House, the publisher, it's his take on the roots of the economic crisis that we have now in the country and how we could respond. And again, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Lines are full here. We'll get on to the next caller. Someone in Montgomery County, I do believe, on our line number four right here. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. Sure. Right off the get-go, kind of sounds like we got a little Ron Paul bashing going on right here, right off the gate. I would like to ask your guest, how does he feel about revoking personhood for corporations?
I feel very good about saying that corporations do not have the right of free speech like individuals. They have a different legal status, and they have different responsibilities. And we had 100 years of law which had that very clear difference built in until this Supreme Court came along and made the equation. And I think it was absolutely dreadful and contrary to established law in the country. You detected correctly a bit of Ron Paul bashing, because I take a very different view from him about the role of government. Let me be clear, by the way. I'm in favor of a market economy. I'm in favor of the private sector. I've helped countries all over the world to have a private sector. I worked on dismantling the communist system in Eastern Europe. I have no affection for that at all. But when Ron Paul says that we should abolish the education department, the energy department, the commerce department, the interior department, which is our environment department, and housing and urban development, and, by the way, and all foreign aid. I know that's not loved, but I work with people who would die in large numbers were it not for some help. I find all of that a misconception about government. I'm not saying government is the leader in job growth and is the one who hires the people and who's the one that leads the economy, but I am a strong believer in the role of public education. I'm a strong believer that, I mean, it's quite obvious, we need an energy strategy in this country which addresses our national security as well as our environmental needs. We absolutely need an environment policy, both the Environmental Protection Agency and Interior, because before we had it, our great forests were getting destroyed. Before we had National Park Service, our remarkable and unique natural heritage in this country was being destroyed, and because we face very, very serious environmental threats from pollution and many other dangers. So my view is that we need a mixed economy, so-called, one in which government is doing what it does. I'm so proud to be a product of America's public schools, and I would, now that we live in an age when higher education is so vital, I want us to do more to ensure that more of our kids can make it all the way through college. This is a tradition, after all, which goes back at least to Abraham Lincoln when he signed the Morrill Act in 1862 and established the land-grant universities. We've always recognized this kind of role. And to start denying it, in my mind, would be to condemn America to a fourth-rate life and a really mean kind of life. So that's where I differ. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm all for a market economy. I just want balance, and I want people at the top to obey the law, not to run our government. That Ron Paul and I agree on. And I want them to pay more taxes, that we don't agree on, but I think they would do just fine. I meet a lot of millionaires and billionaires. They could do just fine helping to make sure that the rest of our society has a chance.
Is it not true that corporations were granted personhood? This is what I'm getting to, though.
Oh, sorry. Well, yeah, but in a way,
you no longer have legal status as a person.
Yeah, it's just a, I think there's a whole mix of legal issues there. A legal person at some level means the right to sign contracts and the right to take on debts in the name of the company and so on. So certain aspects of personhood, so-called, are absolutely just part of what a corporation is. And I think the corporate form of business has a great deal of merit in helping to mobilize capital for good things. But the problem is making a legal person of a corporation equivalent to a flesh and blood person of an individual, seeing no difference in that, that's a disaster.
Is that not the case, that corporations are, in fact, legally the same as a flesh and blood human?
Well, it hasn't been, except that this Supreme Court's moving them closer and closer. That's the problem. When
Our
the Supreme
program.
Court can't
How do you
tell
feel
the
about
difference,
that?
And it, in this infamous case called Citizens United, it did precisely what you're saying, sir. It basically equated the corporation with a flesh and blood individual, and that, I think, is shocking. So they took a more complex legal document doctrine and simplified it to the point not only of absurdity, but danger to us.
Now, with regards to unemployment, national security, and poverty, as someone from a rural background, it occurs to me, and I could trot you out dozens of quotes from real smart, famous people, that the land is the ultimate social security. Now, how do you feel about the current farm programs?
Well, I have problems with some of them. I don't like the ethanol program at all, because that just seems to me to be kind of a waste of money. To turn our food and feed grains into the gas tank, I think, is unbecoming of America's role in feeding the world. I think it's diverting our resources in a bad direction. It's contributing to rising world food prices, which is really quite devastating for a lot of people in this country and internationally. And it's not really solving our energy problems, which aren't going to be solved by turning 30 or 40% of our corn production into the gas tank. So I think we really have to look. But that's a major program that I would do away with.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have several people holding and would like to give some others a chance, and we only have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. I want to go on and go to our next, and that is Champaign County, and this is line number two. Hello.
Hi. The 14th Amendment was abused to give corporations personhood, and it's been a long-standing thing, and I think that's a good history for people to look at. But I have a short question with no particular need for a follow-up this time. And that's to get you to comment on the financial transaction tax. So we've got a situation where Borisov, I believe his name in the EU, has come around to it. And I think the UK has said we won't do it unless the US does. And I think the UK actually has some version of a financial transaction tax already. But Gentner's loose paraphrase has said it ain't going to happen. And it seems to me it's another example of the corporate power, because we have this surreal casino economy that needs to be slowed down, and a tax would help with that. And environmentalists say that should be done, that any of these globally enforced taxes, or whatever you want to call them, collected, some portion of that should be dedicated towards the environmental crisis, obviously. But that probably sounds too much like world government for a lot of people.
Well, I think you have the facts right. The European Union and the head of the European Commission, Barroso, has said financial transactions tax is a good idea. As you said, Prime Minister Cameron and Chancellor George Osborne in the UK said, okay, we'll go with it, but we have the City of London. We need Wall Street also. And then Geithner, who basically comes from Wall Street, said, no, we're not going to do that. And by the way, as if it's some completely bizarre, newfangled tax, many countries have a financial transactions tax. New York has one, but bizarrely, it is collected and then remitted back to the brokerage houses because of a decision some decades ago during a recession that this year we won't collect it, but deciding that, they decided not to collect it ever since. And this is the power of the Wall Street lobby. And President Obama, if he were really the agent of change that he promised to be, would be rising above this, and he would now be siding with much of the world that says, yes, we have a casino economy. Yes, we need to slow down some of these transactions. Yes, a very small tax on huge volumes of transactions would not only help stabilizing these markets, but would also raise a lot of revenues on an undertaxed sector. So I'm with you, and I've called for it myself, and I'm trying to urge both the U.S. and the U.K. to get on board.
Our guest, just to introduce again, for anybody who might have tuned in, is Jeffrey Sachs. He's an economist at Columbia University. He's director of the Earth Institute. And if you'd like to read more of his thoughts on the current economic situation in this country and what to do about it, you could look at his new book, which is titled The Price of Civilization. Random House is the publisher. Again, we'll go to another caller. This is Spring Bay in line three. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Sachs, you're coming across very differently than what I had read about you in The Shock Doctrine.
Yeah, that book, which I liked a lot of, I thought it didn't understand me at all.
Let me just ask a question, and I'll get off the line. Could you give us a couple of policy recommendations how we get ourselves out of this fix? And I'll get off the line and listen
great.
Off air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think that we need to raise the corporate tax collections by about 1% of GDP. I think we need to raise a net worth tax on high wealth individuals. I would put the threshold at $5 million of net worth and above, and a 1% net worth tax would raise another 1% of GDP. I think we could raise another percent of GDP by eliminating those really destructive tax breaks for carried interest and for the maximum capital gains tax and for the top tax brackets, and that would be another percent of GDP, all of which would be paid for at the top, which, believe me, has the wealth and money and incomes to do it. And I would end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I would stop trying to defend against the Soviet invasion, something that we could have stopped trying 20 years ago, allowing us to cut our military presence in Europe significantly. All told, that would raise about 5 or 6 percentage points of GDP. That would enable us to get our budget deficit under control in the next 2 or 3 years, and also start investing again in our country. The primary investments I would urge are on our young people, young children in early childhood through primary and secondary education, and then enough support for higher education so that we can start graduating about half at least of our young people in a college degree, in a bachelor's degree. I would also invest in our infrastructure. I'd love to get that, some of that wind power in the Dakotas and some of the solar power in the Mojave, but that requires a power grid. That requires an energy strategy, which we don't have in this country. I think there's lots of investment we could make that would renovate our country, modernize our country, empower people. It would make the rich just pay a little bit of their vast wealth, but we would have a not only a fairer country, but we'd have a lot more prosperous and also a lot safer country than the one we do right now.
All right, one more caller, at least. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm calling to ask a question I hope you can answer. It's about Social Security. I have heard that the Congress, the government, borrowed $3 trillion, I think it was in from a Social Security trust fund, and I think it was sometime in the 80s, and it's never, ever been paid back, and so I consider it stolen, and now they want to eliminate Social Security. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, I but just keep up your voice. No one's going to eliminate Social Security, I believe, because this country would really go bonkers. People want Social Security. People depend on it. People are frightened of this discussion. Even the Republican government cutters are smart enough not to go after Social Security right now. Paul Ryan, who recklessly, in my view, and cruelly went after the poor in saying that he would cut Medicaid, didn't touch Social Security. And Ron Paul, I don't think, has called for eliminating Social Security. I stand to be corrected, but as far as I know, he did not. I think that Social Security needs gradual reform over a period of decades, nothing abrupt that would jeopardize people who are on Social Security now, who are coming into Social Security. The system is not broken. When we have a problem of entitlements, it's more on the health care side because of rising health care costs, not Social Security. And even there, it's not the fault of Medicare and Medicaid. It's the fault of a health system overall, which is about twice as expensive as any other country's health system because of the profits and the management expenses of our private health insurance schemes. So I would say that keep the voice up to defend Social Security. I think it will work. I think we can and need to afford Social Security for decades to come. If there are adjustments to be made, they should be made very gradually. People depend on Social Security for their survival in old age and their well-being, and we need to defend the system. And fortunately, the vast majority of Americans agree with that. Mm.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. We just have a couple of minutes left. You know, I was interested to read a review of the book that was published in The Guardian, the British paper.
Yeah.
It was by a British academic, and he had some issues with some of the things you said in the book. But something that I thought was kind of striking was that he said that it was a very American book, and not just because it focuses on the United States, but because he wrote it is suffused with classic American optimism. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and I wonder what you think about that kind of reaction, and in fact, whether you find some way to be optimistic.
I am optimistic, and I do feel American optimism because our country has solved problems in the past. We did it in the Progressive Era. We did it in the New Deal. We did it in the 1960s, an era in which I grew up. And I watched us put a man on the moon. I watched us take on the civil rights challenge, thank God. I watched us grow as a country, and I know we can do it again. And I do have to say, I remember distinctly giving a lecture at the Royal Society in the UK, which is one of the world's greatest scientific establishments, and lots of the poobahs of UK society were present. And I gave a kind of American talk about how we could solve global problems. And then for about a half an hour of comments, all the comments came down to, no, we can't. And it was very striking for me. So I think maybe Skidelsky's review really was expressing British lord's view of measured skepticism. But I'm more American than that. I do believe that we can take on these challenges. I think our country is in a mess right now.
Well, and he does.
And I think that the Occupy Wall Street movement is a glimmer of hope because it's young people who are saying that they want to take some responsibility and leadership for our country, and I really admire that.
Yeah. Well, referencing that, I think it's really interesting because also this reviewer made comments, something to the effect of, you know, if indeed the both major parties here in the United States have led Americans astray or served them poorly, he raises the question, well, why is it really that the American people haven't, he doesn't quite put it this way, but, you know, why aren't they out in the streets?
And now they are.
And now they are. At least
and
some people are.
Yeah. Cities. And I think, yeah. I think it's a good step forward.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just about at the point that we have to finish. I don't know if we maybe have about another minute or so. If there is yet another particular one, really last thing that you'd like to leave with.
Well, I would like to say I've been down on Wall Street a few times with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and as I've been having the fun of being in different parts of the country in the last couple of weeks, in the West Coast, now in the Midwest. There's a lot of support for change. There really is. That's how President Obama got elected. But people want real change. They do want the corrupted politics to end. They want the money out of the system. And I think that we can see the glimmerings of a new political movement that's really going to be based on ending this kind of what I call a corporatocracy rather than a democracy. And when we get back to more democratic politics, that's little d democratic politics, more of people speaking, we're going to also have better policies in this country.
Our guest, Jeffrey Sachs, is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He is the author of a newly published book. The title of his book is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. It's just recently out, published by Random House. He's spending some time traveling around the country talking about the ideas in the book. He's in Chicago today. Professor Sachs, thank you very much.
Well, what a pleasure to be with you. Thank you. And I think it's a good step forward.
Yeah. Well, I think we're just about at the point that we have to finish. I don't know if we maybe have about another minute or so. If there is yet another particular one, really last thing that you'd like to leave with.
Well, I would like to say I've been down on Wall Street a few times with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and as I've been having the fun of being in different parts of the country in the last couple of weeks. In the West Coast, now in the Midwest, there's a lot of support for change. There really is. That's how President Obama got elected. But people want real change. They do want the corrupted politics to end. They want the money out of the system. And I think that we can see the glimmerings of a new political movement that's really going to be based on ending this kind of what I call a corporatocracy rather than a democracy. And when we get back to more democratic politics, that's little d democratic politics, more of people speaking, we're going to also have better policies in this country.
Our guest, Jeffrey Sachs, is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He is the author of a newly published book. The title of his book is The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. It's just recently out, published by Random House. He's spending some time traveling around the country talking about the ideas in the book. He's in Chicago today. Professor Sachs, thank you very much.
Well, what a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Jumpstart the October Fun Drive with a successful Power Hour Thursday morning at 7 o'clock. We'll use the Member Match Fund to match your pledge, dollar for dollar. Your pledge will go twice as far during Power Hour. Together, we can raise the money needed to bring you the programs you value. Join us at 7 o'clock Thursday morning, answer the Member Match Challenge, and help WILL Radio keep you better informed about the world, the nation, and our community. Thanks.
Our program focuses here every morning. You know, you can go back and listen to past programs that you might have missed, or there might even be some that you think it'd be worth a second listen. And you can then check also on the schedule and find out what we will be doing in the days ahead. If you haven't visited our website, why don't you do that? It's WILL.illinois.edu. There's information there on the programming on all of our stations, AM, FM, and television, and also an opportunity through the website to make comments on the programs that you hear on the station. So take a look at it. It's WILL.illinois.edu. Coming up in the next part of Focus, we'll be talking about the internal clock that is in all kinds of living things, human beings included. We have a way of keeping track of time, and that's something that's very important because it helps regulate an awful lot of our behaviors, and it can cause problems if it's not working correctly. We'll talk in the next hour with a researcher here from the University of Illinois. Her name is Martha Gillette, and we'll talk about some of the research that she has done, she and others here at the university, on the neurobiology of time and the master clock in the brain, how it works and how sometimes it doesn't work. That's in the next hour of the show. First, though, as we do at this time, we'll take a break for news from National Public Radio and an update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Wheat futures are up as much as 2%, and that is notching gains and building on gains that we've seen the last 3 days, so now the fourth day in a row. some short covering going on in the marketplace tied to what apparently is a weaker U.S. dollar that we're seeing here on our chart, as well as firm equities amid hopes that just maybe we might see a resolution coming soon on the Eurozone debt crisis and problems. European unions are expected to take the leaders there aggressive steps at a summit on this weekend to resolve the region's debt crisis, and that is lifting the price of the euro against the dollar somewhat. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars.